Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 194, Life Among the Piranhas, an Amazonian Psychology with Daniel Everett. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
When the MIT team came to visit in January of 2007, after they'd been there for a few days, I mean, these are well-trained psychologists. Two of them said, these must be the happiest people anywhere. And I said, well, that's sort of subjective, isn't it? How could you ever evaluate who's happier? Oh, well, we would measure the time they spent smiling and laughing and compare that to the time other people spent smiling and laughing. They said it half jokingly, but they were impressed, just like I was, with how much time the Piranhas spend smiling, laughing, talking animatedly. It's rare to see them. You do see unhappy Piranhas, but very rarely. And there has to have been some real traumatic event. They don't sit around brooding. And they're an example in that respect because their lives aren't easy.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. Daniel L. Everett. Dan Everett is professor of linguistics, anthropology, and biological sciences, and chairman of the Department of Languages, Literatures, and Cultures at Illinois State University in Normal, Illinois. He received his PsyD from the Universidade Estadual de Campinas, Brazil, in 1983. He has taught at the Universidade Estadual de Campinas, the University of Pittsburgh, and the University of Manchester, England. He is also a frequent visiting scientist at the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology in Leipzig, Germany. He has conducted research in the Amazon jungle of Brazil for more than 30 years and has authored nearly 100 scientific articles and 6 books. His most recent book is Don't Sleep, There Are Snakes, Life and Language in the Amazon Jungle. His research on the Piranha Indians of Brazil and his conclusions on the evolution and nature of human language have sparked tremendous controversy internationally. He's been featured in the New Yorker magazine, New Scientist magazine 3 times, Scientific American, Science News, The Guardian, Der Spiegel, The Independent, El Mundo, and other newspapers in countries from Holland, India, Japan, and elsewhere, including extensive coverage in most Brazilian newspapers and news magazines. PBS Nova and the BBC are planning a documentary on his research. He speaks Portuguese, Piranha, Spanish, and English. Now, let's go to the interview. Dr. Dan Everett, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you for having me.
You've written an absolutely fascinating book detailing your adventures in the Brazilian Amazonian jungle with an Aboriginal tribe that has had very little contact with the outside world and whose language is apparently unrelated to all other known language groups. Evidently, your linguistic research there has kicked up quite a storm in academic circles because it challenges the work of Noam Chomsky.
Yes, it's kicked up quite a storm in academic circles, not only because it challenges the work of Chomsky, but because it actually challenges the work of a lot of linguists who aren't even Chomskyans, by my claim that culture can affect the overall shape of a grammar. This is something that many linguists, but certainly not all, thought we got beyond 50 years ago. But if I'm right, that was a wrong turn that we made.
Wow. Well, as you know, the focus of my show is psychology, and most of my past guests have been psychologists. But when I heard about your book, it seemed to me that your encounters with the people who are living a life that's so much out of the past may shed light on our basic human nature, our underlying nature prior to all the modern trappings of civilization. My thought was that these people might provide us with a sort of snapshot of early psychology and consciousness, and that's why I'm so excited to speak with you today.
Well, that's great. I mean, I do believe that the implications of this research and the Pitahaya themselves for psychology is profound, and in fact, the most recent work that's been published that I was a co-author on involved several MIT faculty members from brain and cognitive sciences traveling down to the Amazon in 2007 to test my claims. And the first paper from that research has now appeared in the journal Cognition, and was picked up by Discover magazine as one of the top 100 science stories of 2008, confirming what I said about the absence of numbers in Pitahaya.
Well, that's really great. It confirms my intuition that there's good psychological meat here, and maybe we can go into that a bit more. But before we get into all that, fill us in a bit on your background and the circumstances that led you and your family to go off into the wilds of the Amazon.
Well, when I first went to the Amazon, becoming an academic or doing research, publishing in journals, creating an academic storm of any kind were the farthest things from my mind. I was a graduate of the Moody Bible Institute in Chicago, Illinois. I grew up in Southern California and became a Christian when I was about 17, got married at 18, went off to Moody Bible Institute and prepared and eventually left for Brazil as a missionary to translate the Bible for the Pitahaya, who we had been told was a very difficult group, recalcitrant, reticent to accept the Christian gospel, and spoke in extremely difficult, unusual language. And so that's how we came to be assigned to the Pitahaya, and my initial motives for going there just couldn't be more different than my motives for working with them today.
When you first went down there, that was about 30 years ago, is that right?
We went in October of 1977.
Okay, my math isn't fast enough to figure that out.
32 years.
Okay, thank you. I need all the assistance I can get. I grew up in Southern California myself and also in a fairly fundamentalist Christian environment, and so I'm familiar with the Moody Institute and share a similar background with you in that regard. As a matter of fact, I had fantasies. You know, I was kind of programmed to go off and be a missionary in Africa or something.
Mm-hmm.
You went down there as a missionary to convert them, but I have the impression they ended up converting you to some degree.
Oh, it wasn't. Yeah, not just to some degree, completely. Actually, I mean they represented a complete disconnect between what I had been led to believe tribal societies would be like. I sort of had the idea that these people who would be waiting for people to come and tell them about the good news of Jesus Christ, that they were in the darkness of sin and that they were going to perish without the Word of God. I mean, all these phrases were strongly embedded in me as I went down there. And then I got down there and found that, A, they were quite happy, and B, they really couldn't give a rip about the message I had. It didn't fit at all. That challenged my thinking. Just to see how indifferent they were to what I had to say and how happy they were already began the process of reevaluating my own spiritual stance.
Yeah, and I was fascinated by that aspect, certainly, and by your courage, in fact, to be, you know, to be open to looking at your own stance and to reconsidering, you know, what you went down there programmed to do. You know, there's so much information in your book, and we're not going to be able to cover it all, clearly. There were some facts about Brazil that really struck me, things that I didn't know. For example, that Brazil is larger than the continental U.S. I didn't know that.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And that Brazil is mostly jungle, and yet most Brazilians have never been in the jungle.
That's right. I mean, it's astounding for some people to realize that Brazil, which is by far the most populous nation of South America, more people live in Brazil than all the other countries of South America combined, which makes Portuguese the number one spoken language in South America, not Spanish. Most of them live in the states of the South. 40% of the population of Brazil lives in the small state of São Paulo.
Yeah, and now I didn't know it was the most populous country either, so that shows how well-informed I am as an American. The title of your book is Don't Sleep, There Are Snakes. This is something the Pitaha say to one another before going to bed. Is it kind of like we say, sleep tight, don't let the bed bugs bite?
It's pretty similar to that, although it reflects something in Pitaha culture that we don't share. I mean, we say, sleep tight, don't let the bed bugs bite, but then we do, in fact, intend to sleep tight. When the Pitaha say, don't sleep, there are snakes, that's a similar, you know, sort of humorous statement, and they can even tailor that to individual people. So my ex-wife was, in fact, not afraid of snakes, but she was afraid of tarantulas. So they often told her, don't sleep, there are tarantulas.
Uh-huh.
It's part of it is the value that they have of not losing control of yourself. And if you sleep soundly for lots of hours, that's a way of losing control and not being aware of your environment. It's dangerous, and it also is not a value that they have. I mean, they have a value to always be aware. And so they tend not to sleep soundly for 8 hours a night.
Yeah, I was struck by that. You point out that the jungle is, in fact, a dangerous place to be unconscious, and so they tend to take lots of naps, and you point out that, you know, maybe the longest they might sleep at a stretch would be 2 hours, and that at any hour of the day or night, people would be out fishing or talking, chatting, other kinds of things going on.
Yes, that's right. I mean, it's not to say that somebody doesn't, you know, you can't find people who are sleeping all night long, but it's rare, and one of the strangest sounds in the village, the most eerie sound in the village, whether night or day, is silence. Just to have the absence of conversation, it's almost never experienced. And when you do suddenly realize that there's no noise coming from the village, something must be up. I usually run over to the village when I hear, when people stop talking. And at night, it's about as rare to hear silence as it is during the day.
Interesting. Now, you've already made reference to the fact that you were struck by how happy these people were, and your descriptions mostly portray them as laughing, playful, carefree, even though jungle life is quite hard.
Yep.
Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's right. When the MIT team came to visit in January of 2007, after they had been there for a few days, I mean, these are well-trained psychologists. Two of them said, these must be the happiest people anywhere. And I said, well, that's sort of subjective, isn't it? How could you ever evaluate who's happier? Oh, well, we would measure the time they spent smiling and laughing and compare that to the time other people spent smiling and laughing. They said it half jokingly, but they were impressed, just like I was, with how much time the Pitaha spend smiling, laughing, talking animatedly. It's rare to see them. You do see unhappy Pitaha, but very rarely. And there has to have been some real traumatic event. They don't sit around brooding. And they're an example in that respect because their lives aren't easy. So, you know, I complain. It makes me feel like a complainer very often when I'm in the village because things that I find difficult are just as hard for them as they are for me, but they don't express any sense of difficulty.
Well, I'm glad to hear that you had psychologists go down and who confirm your observation about their happiness, because otherwise one might suspect, well, here's somebody, you know, who's fallen into that sort of noble savage, you know, myth or assumption, a kind of romanticized view of village life. But you point out that it's not romantic in the sense of being easy, but nevertheless, they do seem to be happy.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I remember in the first year or so when I was still a missionary and had a missionary mindset, I wasn't interested really in understanding their culture. And it was frustrating to me because they just seemed to be a bunch of people on a campout. I hadn't noticed all the tight connections and subtle nuances of their culture, but they just seemed to be joking around all the time, and they didn't seem to take life seriously. And you know, for a Christian missionary, that's a serious flaw. It took me some time to realize that was in fact the opposite of a flaw and a significant strength in the face of difficulty.
That's really fascinating. So How would you describe their psychology, other than this happiness that we've been talking about? And I know it's tough to generalize, but do you have any kind of overall observations about their psychology?
Well, for the Pitahā, one of the most important goals is to be what they call in their language, chigesai, which is hard and or tough. And even though they smile a lot, they are lean, mean fighting machines. The Pitahā have incredible endurance, and this is a very important value that they have. They know the behavior of any animal, any kind of living creature in the jungle. They know everything there is to know from the point of botanists about plants. They probably have a knowledge about their environment that rivals any biologist or botanist and probably is superior to it in many ways. They're completely familiar and with their environment and develop the skills to live in it. They have adapted to the jungle there to an amazing degree. I mean, many other groups do this as well, but they also manifest a sense of pride in themselves that is hard to find elsewhere, even in the Amazon. So they've resisted change for over 300 years, obviously, which is when they were first contacted. But obviously, there have been a couple of changes here and there, but the striking thing is that the groups around them have almost completely enculturated into Brazilian society, whereas the Pitahā remain as they were described in the 1700s by the priests who first visited them.
Yeah, and that's what makes them so fascinating and almost kind of a laboratory of something about basic human nature, I would think. Did you see any signs of what we would consider mental illness?
No, there were some people who were born with congenital defects, and so you had a couple of in my experience, I've seen perhaps two people that are retarded mentally in their development, and nobody who seemed to be having severe mental illness or personality disorders or that sort of thing. I've never really seen anything like that, and I know all the Pitahā. That's a very interesting fact about them.
You say you know them all. I was struck to encounter in the book. I got the impression there are maybe only about 300.
That's right. There are just over 300 Pitahā, and over the last 30 years, I've gotten to know every single one of them. There are, of course, new babies and small children that I haven't gotten to know, but anyone, in adolescence on, I know.
Did they used to be a much larger group?
The evidence we have is that, like other Amazonian groups, all languages of the Americas, all groups of the Americas, they were once much larger. The estimates of the entire group by the early priests and explorers who went there, although often these have to be taken with a grain of salt, is that they were upwards of 60,000 people, and so today they're in the 300s.
Wow, they're kind of a precious resource then.
Yes.
And in the past we've referred to these kinds of people as, quotes, primitive, but from your description, they're not in any way stupid. It sounds like they're exceedingly bright in terms of the very detailed knowledge of animals and the environment, as you pointed out.
Yeah, the jungle is a demanding place, and if you don't have your mind very well developed and you're not alert and sensitive and knowledgeable about where you're at, you're not going to survive very long. I mean, when they take me to the jungle, they find me astoundingly ignorant and poorly adapted and not very adept at even learning about the jungle. They just find it astounding that someone has to be shown the same path, several times. You walk out in the jungle a couple of kilometers, and I'm totally lost. And they know exactly where they're at. Now, of course, they have the same experience when they come to a city. They get lost very easily. although I should say that they don't get as lost as easily as we do in their environment. Because their first question, since they don't use left or right, they navigate by river. Their first question is, where is the river? And as soon as you can tell them in a city, which in Brazil is easy because all cities just about have rivers, where the river is, they get a map of the place in their head. So I took a Pinaha out of the tribe to the hospital one time in Porto Velho, Brazil. It was his first time ever out of the tribe. He went to the hospital in this very large city of Porto Velho, and he had only seen my home in Porto Velho one time. I took him to my home, which was 25 kilometers outside of town, you know, about 12 to 15 miles outside of town. He saw it was near the river. I took him to the hospital, and I left him at the hospital, and I said, I'll be back to see you tomorrow. He said, I don't want to stay, and I said, but you have to stay. The doctors will take care of you. In the morning, he showed up at my house. He walked all the way, never having been there before, in his hospital gown, because he didn't want to be in the hospital without me. And I don't think I would have been capable of doing a similar feat if I had stayed with, you know, been lost in the Pinaha.
Yes.
I think I'd still be there.
Yes. Now, their language is so unique. Maybe you can tell us a bit about their language, and also give us a sample, if you could, you know, speak several sentences of it, because I know that you pointed out the tonality is an important aspect, as in Chinese,
yeah.
and you talk about glottal stops, and I'm not even sure if I really know what a glottal stop is or not.
Okay, well, I'll give you a couple of samples of their language. So, first of all, what's a glottal stop? Here's the word for macaw in Pinaha. Ka-ai. Ka-ai. Here's the word for small caiman in Pinaha. Ka-ai. Ka-ai. The difference between those two is the number of glottal stops they have. So every time you hear that ah sound, that's so ka-ai. That break between the vowels is a glottal stop.
Okay.
Now, to give you an idea of the tones, one of my favorite examples is the word for friend is magiai. And the word for enemy is magiai.
I didn't hear a difference.
let me whistle them. The word for friend is magiai. I'll accent the tones a little more strongly there so it's easier to hear. And I can whistle that. Whereas the word for enemy is magiai. And if you don't get the tones right, you've really confused them.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of other examples like that. And so they only have three vowels and eight consonants. And that's one of the, there are only two other languages in the world known, Hawaiian and Rotoka spoken in New Guinea, that have similar small numbers of sounds. And yet with the tones, which Hawaiian and Rotoka don't actually have, they're able to do, you know, communicate anything that they need to communicate. But then their syntax, their word structure is extremely complicated. You know, I've been accused of trying to simplify their grammar, but if you read my doctoral dissertation, long time ago, you find out that the word structure is extremely complicated, much more complicated than English or Portuguese or any Indo-European language. And the grammar itself is fascinating for a number of reasons, but primarily what has gotten it famous is what it doesn't appear to have and the link that I have claimed to exist between culture and the grammar itself.
Okay, maybe we'll come back to that. I suspect that there's an intimate relationship between language and consciousness. Can you comment on the ways in which the characteristics of their language appear to impact what they are and are not aware of?
Well, one obvious example is the absence of number words in their language. So this is the first language ever documented which doesn't even have the word for one. There is no word for one.
Amazing.
This means that, so when we did these psychological experiments that came out in the journal Cognition, one of the things that comes to mind and that we tested for is how much of what we can talk about relative to quantities is bound up with numbers? Are we able to talk about quantities because we have numbers? Or are there some cognitive characteristics that exist prior to numbers? And we found out that the Pitahā have a sense of exactness. So they can do exact matches under, you know, so they can match up things. You know, give them so many balloons and so many spools of thread, and they can match them up and not leave one hanging over. And if there is one left over, they tell you it's left over, in a sense. So they know that they have a sense of exactness without a sense of numbers. And some people had thought that we get the sense of exactness from numbers. It tells us that numbers are a cognitive technology. They enable us to talk effectively about larger quantities and reason effectively about larger quantities. So without those words in their language, obviously the Pitahā are very limited in what they can reason about quantitatively. Another example is the fact that they don't have fixed words for color, although they can describe colors. They don't have certain kinds of tenses we have. One thing they do have, every Pitahā verb has to have a suffix that tells you whether the evidence for your assertion is direct observation, hearsay, or deduction. So if I say, is John here? If you saw him leave, you could say, John is not here, and put the suffix on that means direct observation. If I ask you the same question and you only heard someone say that John left, you use that suffix. And if I ask you if John is here and you look down at the water and his canoe's missing, you can say he's not here and put the deduction suffix on there.
That sounds like a very useful feature of language, one that maybe would be useful to us.
Yeah, it's a fascinating feature of language. They're not the only language that has these kinds of particles, but they're very interesting and used. Of course, whenever you have something like this, it facilitates lying. So if you want to say that somebody's gone, you can just put this, but you know in fact that they haven't gone. You put the suffix on there that says, I saw him leave, and that makes it somehow more convincing. So, you know, they can lie like we can lie.
Yeah, yeah. I'm thinking of the what's been called the Whorfian hypothesis, I think, or
right.
Finding, for example, the fact that Eskimos have many, many words for snow, and as a consequence, they perceive a lot of different kinds of snow than most of us would be able to perceive. And so I'm thinking that maybe there are similar things that go on there. For example, I'm recalling an episode that you described where a bunch of Pitahā are standing on the riverbank looking across the bank to the other shore. And you go over to see, well, what is it they're all talking about and staring at? And it's a spirit. And they all agree that they see a spirit, but you don't see the spirit. I'm wondering if that's kind of like the snow, that somehow there's a category of experiencing that they've developed, somehow maybe tied in with their language or their culture, that's close to you.
Well, I'm sure that there are many things that exist in their culture and language that tied to the culture in a way that probably are close to me. In that particular case, I to this day don't fully understand what I saw. I mean, that is to say, I know that there was not a spirit there, and I know that they say there was a spirit there, but I don't have a good explanation for that disjunction in our perception. But one example that does come to mind for language is they don't have words for left or right, you know, so these are relative directional terms, and they're common in lots of languages of the world, but not all. So since the Pitahā don't have left or right, how do they tell each other which way to turn? Or how do you give anybody directions? Well, you say, wherever you're at, turn up river, turn down river, turn towards the jungle, or turn towards the water. That means you always have to know where those things are. And so this linguistic fact that they don't have left or right, but navigate using fixed features of their topography, has been shown, and I've already noticed this myself in the example I gave you of the fellow who found his way back to my house from the hospital. But other researchers, for example, at the Max Planck Institute for Psycholinguistics in Nijmegen, have shown that people in systems like this actually are able to navigate better in brand new environments than people who come from languages like English, where we tend to use relative terms that aren't fixed in the geography or topography, such as left and right. Now, if you're an English speaker and you mainly use north, south, east, or west, then you're functioning like a Pitaha, because that's, in effect, what we're doing when we use north, east, south, west. But most of us don't do that. Most of us, you know, you tell somebody, turn left, but you wouldn't say, turn west, because most people wouldn't know which way west was in a quick-acting response.
Okay. Some of us do that more naturally than others, though. I sort of tend to know where north, east, south, west are, usually. But
yeah.
But a lot of people don't. You're right.
No, I'm one of the ones who has to stop and think about it. I mean, obviously, if I see the sun, I know where things are. But it isn't something that's pervasive in our culture. So, in effect, what I'm saying is that any Pitaha would know immediately west, east, north, south. That would just be, that's the only direction they use. Whereas Americans, or Brits, or just about any European might happen to know the directions, relative to where they're at in any new place, but they might not, too.
Yeah.
And when they don't, left and right gets to be a very sloppy way of telling someone how to get somewhere.
Now, we mentioned spirits. What can you tell us about the religion? Do they have anything that, you know, you would consider to be, quotes, a religion?
No, I wouldn't really classify it as a religion in the sense that they believe in any kind of norms that should control the way we behave based on supernatural entities or supernatural history of some sort. They believe that the universe is occupied by a number of entities. So just as it has monkeys and it has humans, it has things that look like humans that aren't humans because they have slightly different characteristics. And I've translated the words for these creatures as spirit very frequently, but they don't have an exact concept of spirit like we do, you know, some sort of bodiless entity that, you know, can take form or not take form, you know, some sort of magical entity. These other things that they believe that they see, like the example that I give at the beginning of the book where they're looking at the beach and see something and I don't, they believe to have real physical limitations and real physical properties just like we do, except that they have additional properties or lack properties that we have. And some of them are mean and some of them are nice. It depends on who you talk to. And this doesn't really fit religion. It's sort of like a different kind of classification of the world. But it is very important in their day-to-day life. And I guess the closest thing they have to employing that as a religion is that they're use them to occasionally like boogeymen to talk to their kids. You know, watch out, you go out there and this spirit will get you. Now the adults actually believe that, but the function is to control kids' behavior sometime, and so that's sort of the closest thing they have to a quasi-religious code.
What about some kind of mythology? Do they, what sort of story do they have for, you know, where it all came from, where they came from?
Yeah, they're not interested in that, which makes them extremely interesting for anthropologists and linguists. They don't have any creation myths whatsoever. You cannot get a single story out of the Pitaha. You ask them how the world was, and they will simply tell you it is, the world is like this, which means it's always been this way. They're not curious about that because it's not something that arises. You know, what's to explain? There are trees and fish and we have to live in this environment. We live in this environment. And so this has been very surprising to a lot of people. A Brazilian anthropologist has actually done research on this and I helped him get started. He's a good friend of mine and he published a book in Portuguese in which he confirmed that, in fact, they do not have creation myths.
And so what does this say about their sense of time? Do they have a sense of the past, of the future?
They don't talk about past that goes beyond living witnesses. So there's no taboo against talking about the dead, except, I mean, there are no supernatural taboos against talking about the dead. But once somebody's died, they're sort of gone. I mean, they're not sort of gone. They are gone. And so you might talk about things you did with them or something like that, but you don't talk about... I tried to find the names of grandparents one time in a village, and so it took me quite a while because they don't have real words for grandparents. You have to say so-and-so had a father had a father, that guy had a... And so I could find only one person who could name all their grandparents, and that's because that was the only person who had actually seen all their grandparents in the village because the life expectancy is so low. So unless they had seen them, they didn't know and they didn't talk about them.
Do they have any sense of an afterlife?
No, you don't hear Pinaha talking about the happy hunting ground or anything like that. You're dead, you're dead. They put you in the ground, usually near the river's edge, so that the erosion will in a year or two, take the grave into the water. No, you ask them, where do people go when they die? And, I asked this of somebody who had heard Christian myths as a little boy when he had been raised for a couple of years outside the village, and he tried to give me a response, but then I realized he was just repeating bits of Christian stories that he remembered. In fact, you don't find any Pinaha telling you about an afterlife for any person.
Are there any special roles in the tribe, for example, leaders or shaman, witch doctor, the healer?
No, there are no specialized roles. Everyone does more or less the same thing. Exactly the same thing. It's just some people do it better. So if you're going to go on a hunt, you'll find somebody who's a good hunter and probably do what they tell you. But when the hunt's over, that's the end of their, authority. So there are no specialized roles. There just happen to be, there is recognition that some people do things better than other people, but that doesn't give them any sort of title or special social status.
That's very interesting. What about dreams? Do they have a theory or what? What's their view of dreams? Because we know that everybody dreams.
Yep, and they talk about dreams, and they have a verb for dreaming, which is very interesting because they don't usually have verbs. They don't have verbs for expressing their desires and this sort of thing. They do this with suffixes on a single verb. So, but when they have a dream, they know that they're dreaming versus being awake, but they don't believe that the experiences they have in those states are fundamentally different. They're sort of altered states of consciousness. So somebody will start telling you about something he did, and you say, well, wait a minute. You didn't go anywhere last night. You were sleeping on my, in my living room. I often have Pinaha sleep in the house. And so how could you be out hunting and doing all this stuff at night when I happen to know for a fact you were lying in here sound asleep? Oh, I was doing that in my dreams. But to them, they were really doing those things.
And is the dream imbued with any special significance or meaning? Do they see it as either related to their life or related to a message?
No, they don't. No, they don't get any special symbolic significance out of the dreams. They're just they just recount things they did in their dreams, but they don't try to interpret them or say that I dreamed this and that means that in real life this is going to happen or something like that.
Yeah, so they're very matter of fact.
Yes.
You mentioned sleeping in your house, and they have a very different sense of privacy than we do, and but they do have some sense of privacy. Maybe you can talk about that a bit.
Yes, I mean, they're not worried about you seeing their body parts as long as you don't stare. I mean, there's a sense of modesty. The Pinaha can be completely naked and still be modest. And the way you express modesty is, I mean, you don't look at people. If I'm in the river taking a bath and I don't have any clothes on and a woman comes down, she won't stand and stare. Even if she talks to me, she'll look above my head. You know she's not. And the same thing goes for anything you see like that. They don't, they go off to get privacy to relieve themselves. But if you happen to be walking along and see someone, because they don't, make a big deal of getting private, they just go off a path somewhere in the jungle, and if you're walking down that path, you'll see them. Well, you ignore them. You pretend as though you don't see them, and that's a way of of giving them space and showing modesty on both parts, and also in sexual relations. They tend to be quite private about those things, not always, but in general, they're very private about them.
Do you have any reason or any way of suspecting whether that sense of modesty and privacy is a result of contact with Europeans, or whether it's more or less, innate?
Well, there are certain parts of it. I don't know about innate. I know that, because that's a much wider question than just the Pinaha, but I know that some aspects of their modesty are indigenous to them. They, so relieving themselves in private and that sort of thing, they would just never do it among themselves. Other parts of their modesty are a result of their desire to avoid problems with outsiders, so that they know that if women walk around without any clothes on and Brazilians come, or anybody, I mean any outsiders come, there could be problems, because they have a history, they've seen this happen before. But when they're sure that no outsiders are around, or outsiders they can trust are there, they're completely open about and often don't wear clothes, and they don't wear clothes for modesty when there are people that they can trust are there. So, for example, I was working in the house one time, and this young woman walked in, and she was interested in what I was doing. I was nailing some stuff up in my house, she looked down at her dress and saw there was a rip in it, so she just took her dress off. They don't have anything underneath their dresses, and was fiddling with that while she talked to me. And she wasn't being flirtatious at that time or anything. It was just a perfectly natural thing, because she was treating me like someone else in the village. Whereas if an outsider they didn't know were there, she would have never done that.
Mm-hmm. And say a little bit about marital relations, fidelity, infidelity, and so on.
Well, they vary considerably, just as ours do. I mean, I've often said that just as we are serially monogamous, they are serially monogamous. I mean, so you find people no one has multiple spouses, one person at a time. I know couples that have been together for the past 30 years and probably will be together until they die. I know individuals who have had a succession of spouses, both male and female. When they are together, promiscuity is not, it's not something they take lightly, except in certain circumstances. So it's not that outlandish if everybody's happy and dancing and singing for people to be somewhat promiscuous. But outside of those, but you don't leave the village. It's a very short-term thing, and the punishment for that is pretty mild. There is a little bit of punishment involved, and I talk about it in the book. A man who was, his wife made him keep his head in her lap all day, and anytime he tried to move, she jerked his hair and hit him in the face with a stick. And he laughed about it. I didn't know what was happening. I walked over and I said, "Can you come study with me, and help teach me more of the language?" And he just grinned and said, "I can't go anywhere today." And as soon as he said that, she hit him on the head with this stick and jerked his hair. And I asked somebody else, and they were both sort of laughing. And I asked somebody else what was going on. He says, "Oh, he was, he was with another woman last night, so his wife's not letting him leave today. He has to stay there." And that's about as serious as it's taken. But if you want to have another relationship, sort of get the equivalent of what we might call divorce and remarriage, although those terms don't fit well with the Pinaha, you just go off for a few days with the person you want to be your new spouse, and when you come back, that's accepted, and that's the end of it.
What about homosexuality?
There's a lot of sexual play that's obvious between men, and it goes beyond just horsing around sometimes. So although they're kind of private, I mean, I talk about this in the book, coming out of the, seeing my daughter who was 12 at the time. She's she's older, over in her 30s now. But she was watching two men, on the floor right in front of her with their pants down. They weren't having, actual sexual relations, but they were coming pretty close to it. And and laughing and giggling and weren't being modest at all. But by and large, that doesn't happen. I mean, sexual relations aren't obvious in public. So how much homosexuality there is, as I talk to the men, I get evidence that most of them are bisexual. But it's not something that's normally done openly in the group. And there are a couple of guys who are fairly openly gay. I mean, every man has to have a spouse and children, but this one man in particular talks with the women, have a slightly different dialect from the men, and this fellow talks in the women's dialect.
Interesting. Yeah. What about child rearing? It's they have some pretty different ideas about child rearing than we do.
Well, they don't believe in physical discipline. I mean, you know, there are always exceptions. No matter what a culture's values are, so Americans don't believe that murder is okay, but we have, you know, lots of murderers in jail. So those Americans who would still probably say murder is not okay violated their own norms. So you do find Pinaha, hitting their children from time to time, but by and large, that's almost there. That is not sanctioned in the culture. That is frowned on. You don't hit people. You don't show violence. You don't show anger in the ways that, you know, any really overt displays of emotion like that. And so children learn because from a very early age, they get responsibilities. You know, as soon as they're weaned, they start getting hungry like everybody else. They have to carry things. Things are expected of them. And, you know, if a mother goes into the jungle and gives her little boy who's four, a small load to carry back, and he starts throwing a fit, well, he's going to find himself alone in the jungle because mom's going to keep coming.
Yeah, and you point out that they don't speak baby talk to their children at all. They really treat them kind of as adults, as fully responsible adults from very early on, and that if a mother sees a 2 or 3 year old getting too close to the fire or playing with a knife, you give an example, playing with a sharp knife, they let them go ahead and do it, and maybe they get hurt and take their lumps, but they see that as part of the toughening up process to live in the jungle.
Absolutely. I mean, I had a psychologist from who's now at Columbia University, Peter Gordon, a good friend of mine, came to the tribe with me in the late 80s and early 90s, made a few trips. And he has on film, we were talking, and behind us, we didn't see this happening at the time. We noticed it when we looked at the film. There's a baby that can't even walk, just sitting up with a very sharp butcher knife playing with it. And the mother's talking to us. Now, the baby drops the knife onto the ground. And what does the mother do? She reaches over and picks it up and gives it back to him and then turns around and starts talking to us. I've seen babies I've seen toddlers get cut and burned. But when they reach, 7 or 8, they know how to handle themselves. They're not going to do that anymore. They know what will hurt. They know how to behave around fires and stuff like that. Whereas if you bring in American children of the same age, they're more likely to get seriously hurt than any Pinaha child because they've been protected and sheltered. If a Pinaha child is running and falls down and hurts themselves, the mother isn't going to run over there and say, "Oh, poor baby," and start kissing it. She'll say, "Don't do that again. That hurts." And it still scolds them for falling down and hurting themselves. And if it's a serious hurt, if somebody's hurt seriously, well, they're going to look for help. And they love their children. But if it's minor stuff, the lesson is be more careful next time.
Yeah, this was one of the messages that came through to me in the book, is that these people live in a tough environment, and so they expect toughness of themselves. And in some ways, for you as an outsider, your experience was that they weren't always very helpful. At times when you expected somebody to kind of rush in and you would have considered it to be common courtesy to extend help, they sort of left you to your own devices.
That's right. I remember going there with someone from a phonetician from UCLA in 1994. Or actually 1995, And we had a lot of gear to carry up the riverbank, and the Pitahā, especially these really strong Pitahā men, were all standing around watching us. And the guy, the phonetician, was a professor at UCLA, and he was in his 70s already. And he said, "Isn't anyone going to help us?" I said, "No, they're not going to help us." I said, "They didn't tell us to bring this stuff. They just find us curious." And he said, "Well, can't you pay them to help us?" What would I pay them with? There's nothing they want, you know, that I have, you know, and they're not going to get involved in some other culture's activities for pay. Now, I have had them help me. They will help. They will get engaged like this when it's something either to their direct benefit. So if I'm bringing supplies that they know are going to go for the whole village, they will rush down and help me carry them up. And they might carry them off, too. I might never see them again. So I have to be right with them, but they'll carry them up. And if it's something that has to do with medical help or something like that, I mean, they don't normally... If there is a young man, and the young men are vital components of the culture because they hunt and they protect, the whole village will respond if he's in bad health. And they will to a young woman, too, as long as she's integrated into the society and her husband's there and that sort of thing. Although I don't want to give the impression, having just said that, that there's a big difference between the way men and women are treated. By and large, there aren't. So they'll help sometimes for emergencies or for things that are seen as to the benefit of all. But for the average individual thing, don't expect people to come help you. If you started a project or you've got something to do, you know, do it yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, and of course another dramatic feature of their lives is how little they have in terms of material possessions. They have practically nothing. The shelters they build are extremely simple. They've got maybe a knife or a pot or a pan, and contrast that with you, when you needed to move about, it was like an expedition, you know, with all sorts of belongings and the things that we would consider to be necessities, and yet they can just pick up and go someplace, and it's no problem. And I sort of reflect on that as we enter a difficult economic time, you know, and we worry about our material well-being, and here are these people who have so little and who are quite content.
Yes, they have a standard of living that is very different from ours. If you walk with a Pitahā man into the jungle to gather things, such as Brazil nuts, you might be surprised that he will have a machete with him and nothing else. He'll go barefoot, and you wonder, how are you going to carry this back? Well, he makes a basket when he gets there. After he's gotten what he needs, he makes a big pile, then he walks around and finds just the right kind of leaves and vines, and in about 15 minutes has woven a basket with a tump line, just right to carry his stuff back. And when he gets back, he just tosses that aside and make another one the next day if you need it. They're very confident in their abilities. They can find food. They can identify danger so much better. So one of the problems that we have is that we are so specialized and we have so little knowledge as individuals of our environment and how to live in our environment without electricity or power. Life would be much harder for us if we were placed into an environment like the Pitahās, because we just don't have the cultural underpinnings to survive as they have. It would take a great deal of extra training for the average American to even come close to living like the Pitahā do.
Okay, you've been very generous with your time here. I'm just going to ask you a couple more questions. What about their relationship with other tribes and so on? Do they have a history of warring or a history of peace?
In the 1700s and 1800s, there's evidence that there were wars. I mean, these are partly because of attacks by Brazilians, partly a result of attacks by other Indian groups over different land. But over the last couple of hundred years, they have developed a culture of peace, and the concept of war and conflict is foreign to them now. I mean, they know of other groups, and they fear other groups. that are in their environment. Their typical response is, if you come, I will go. We're not going to fight. So a Pinaha will only fight to defend the lives of their family. Other than that, you know, I've had people come in and hear me speaking with the Pinaha, and they say, oh, if you gave them the order to kill us right now, they would do that, wouldn't they? You know, they have these movie ideas in their mind. And I said, look, if any violence started right now, every one of these people would disappear into the jungle. And if you ran after them and started threatening their families, you would be dead in the jungle. But they're not going to just start fighting. That the wisest course of action for any Pinaha is to retreat and fight only if absolutely threatened. So warfare is now a foreign concept to them.
Well, to sort of begin to wrap things up here, I'm curious what the impact of your 30 years with the Pinaha has been on you personally, on kind of how you see the world, how you think about yourself.
Well, I certainly don't think there's only one way to do things, and so I take lots of claims that psychologists and other scientists make about this or that structure being innate with a grain of salt, because I think back on the Pinaha and the other dozen or so Amazonian languages I've done field work on, and realize that some people live extremely differently from our predictions. I'm not afraid of bugs anymore. I'm used to hard circumstances. That doesn't mean that I like hard circumstances. Give me a good hotel any day over sleeping on the ground. But I can sleep on the ground, and I know how to live in the jungle. And these are things I didn't know growing up in the desert of Southern California. But mainly, I've learned from the Pinaha I haven't learned it nearly as well as I should have, and certainly not like they know it, but to appreciate each day and take satisfaction in life from the day that I have good health and I'm alive right now, and things might not be the same tomorrow, but I'm not worried about tomorrow. They might not have been the same yesterday, but that's gone. And that sounds trite and trivial, and a lot of people have said it, but you know, it's my lesson from the Pinaha. They've taught me this, and they live it every day, and I just feel really privileged to have spent so many years of my life with them.
Well, that's a good reminder for us all. And Dr. Dan Everett, I want to thank you so much for sharing all that you have with us and for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you very much for having me.
I hope you enjoyed this interview with Professor Dan Everett. I first heard about the Pinaha on Heather Gout's Naked Soul podcast. Her brief mention of this tribe in Professor Everett's book stimulated my curiosity to see if I could track him down for an interview. As you can see, I was successful in my quest. In general, as you heard, the Pinaha are a peaceful, nonviolent people. However, like other Aboriginal groups around the world, alcohol can upset their normally peaceful balance. Sometimes Brazilian traders in the area supply them with alcohol, which can lead to bad results. Professor Everett tells the story of overhearing a bunch of drunken Pinaha plotting to kill him and his family one night when he was still fairly new down there. A rogue Brazilian river captain had gotten them drunk and put them up to it. Dr. Everett relates some important lessons he learned from that incident. There's also the harrowing tale of his wife and one of his young daughters nearly dying of malaria on their first trip down there, and their desperate canoe journey downriver to get medical help. How interesting to live in a society in which there are no leaders, nobody is in charge, nobody's the boss of anybody else, men and women and children are treated pretty much equally, and they spend half as much time working to support themselves as we do, as is fairly typical of Stone Age societies, and they don't consider their work burdensome or something they wish they didn't have to do. And they don't have any stuff that they have to maintain or worry about being stolen, or that their neighbors have more than they do. If you enjoy reading true life adventures, I can recommend this book to you, both for the adventure story and the anthropological and linguistic findings it contains. I found it chock full of fascinating information.
That's right. Shrink Wrap Radio. Coming at you now. Yo, everybody, let's get down. There's a new MC in town. Talking psychology interviews. Dr. Dave is all the rave. Ain't no slouch on the digital couch. He's on the pod. Podcast got the pod. Yeah. You want to be in the know? No. Talking shrink wrap radio. Shrink wrap radio. I'm talking shrink wrap radio. Shrink wrap radio. I'm talking shrink wrap radio. Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. All right.
Well, at the moment, I'm not feeling quite so boastful as my little rap ditty would imply. In fact, I'm feeling a bit devastated. Earlier this morning, I conducted an interview with Dr. John Kilstrom on dissociative disorders for my Wise Counsel podcast, and I thought it was one of the best interviews ever. Chock full of information that runs counter to what most people think about such topics as multiple personality, amnesia, hypnotic recovery of memories, post-hypnotic amnesia, the role of trauma on memory, and so on. The interview was so good that I let it run quite a bit longer than usual, only to discover after we hung up that one of the settings on my recording software was off. And I only recorded my side of the conversation. What a loss. I've requested a re-interview, but I don't know if Dr. Kilstrom will be up for it or not. We'll keep our fingers crossed, but I certainly won't hold it against him if he turns me down. I hate it when I make mistakes like that. Clearly, there's one more thing I need to add to my pre-flight checklist. Speaking of Wise Counsel, there is a new interview up there that I think Shrink Wrap listeners will especially appreciate. It's an interview with German psychologist, therapist, professor, and author Jürgen Kreetz on the topic of self-actualization and Rogerian person-centered psychotherapy. And I invited our mutual friend, Dr. Charles Merrill, to join me as a co-interviewer. Charles is my longtime friend and colleague who I interview on Shrink Wrap Radio number 117 on self-disclosure and friendship. And since he's the one who introduced me to Jürgen some years back, I thought it would be good to have him in on the discussion. This is Shrink Wrap Radio number 194, which means that the milestone of number 200 is coming up. Please send audio congratulations that I can play on the show using my voicemail or on Skype, or MyChingo, or phone at 206-337-0622, or by sending me an MP3 file via email. I received a nice one earlier today from listener Joni, which she recorded on her cell phone walking down the street, and it turned out just fine. And I'm looking forward to playing it on the upcoming anniversary show. I don't see any new additions to our Frapper map. If you haven't put yourself on the map, please do so at www.frappr.com/shrinkwrapradio. Also, we've received no new donations. Remember, Shrink Wrap Radio is supported by your kind donations and by your patronage of our sponsors using the discount links on our site for GoDaddy, PetMeds.com, Brookstone, and Budget Car Rentals.
Hi, everybody. This is Sylvia from L.A., and you're on the couch, on a rock, on a boat, on a plane, with Dr. Dave.
Hi, Sylvia. I hope you are still out there listening. Before I forget, I should also mention that this show can also be found on the ProMedNetwork.com website, and selected episodes appear on sciencepodcasters.org as well. Well, I'm running long here, so I'll just read a few recent emails. First, we hear from Mike, who writes, "Hello, I've been listening to your podcasts and many others on various issues concerning the health impact of people targeted by workplace bullies, and discovered that you had a show on such several years ago. Having personally experienced this issue in the workplace and working in New York State legislatively on this issue has provided a link to a particular type of bully that some experts might label as an antisocial personality. As this may be true in some cases, what concerns me, having met some types, such as the borderline personality in support groups, is that people like that can change with behavior modification and medication. The narcissistic and sociopathic bully cannot. It is this type that in our spare time we try to educate people about as attempting to work with your employer in regards to being bullied usually results in a negative outcome. Trying to work with a bully who is narcissistic or sociopathic is even less likely to result in a positive solution. One of my goals is to educate people on how to recognize these types through patterns of behavior and television shows that sadly often glamorize these individuals, and therefore people never recognize the damage being done in their lives and to their health. If you would ever consider another show on such, I'd be willing to talk to you about it. Mike, and he's state coordinator for the New York Healthy Workplace Advocates. It sounds like a very interesting topic, Mike. And I'm remembering interviewing the author of Snakes in Suits. I think that's the subtitle, or maybe that's the main title, a book about sociopaths. And I remember that we talked about them in the workplace as well. So I think there are actually two shows on Shrink Wrap Radio on this topic. But we could certainly have another one. So get in touch if you'd like to be a guest on that topic. The next one reads, Hi, Dr. Dave. I love your podcast so much. It has been inspiring, informative, and entertaining for me for the last year or so. I haven't listened to your show in a bit, but I'm catching up on some of your recent episodes. I suddenly remember something about a listener who had complained extensively about audio problems on the podcast not too long ago, and I never got around to responding to that. As I listened to the email that you read aloud, I was in disbelief. I have never experienced problems as a listener with the audio levels of the show, and any minor problems with the audio have been pointed out by you previously to the start of the show. I was disturbed by the level of dissatisfaction this supposed audio expert had with your show. Anyway, the levels have basically always been great. Keep up the good work. And that's from Nathan in Brooklyn. Nathan, thanks for that feedback. I think that particular listener that you were referring to as an audio professional, his ears just must be much more finely tuned than either yours or mine. Finally, we hear from Dione, who writes again to say, Hi, Dr. Dave. Thank you for following through with my request for an interview with a Lacanian analyst. I really enjoyed the interview on your Wise Counsel podcast and am looking forward to reading Dr. Moncayo's book. I can also recommend to your listeners Bruce Fink's A Clinical Introduction to Lacanian Psychoanalysis. I've read several books on Lacan and dabbled in a few of his well-known seminars, but I haven't found anything as appropriate for the absolute beginner as that particular book by Dr. Fink. It's very accessible and presupposes no detailed knowledge of Western intellectual history. Thanks again for a great interview. I realize it takes two to tango, as I'm sure Dr. Moncayo knows from his time in Buenos Aires. And your questions were not only good ones, but also delivered with good timing. Greetings from Boston, Dione. And by the way, I'm a he. That's in response to the last email I read from Dione, where I wasn't sure if I was talking to a he or a she. So that's good to have that as a point of reference. And Dr. Moncayo, I am interviewing him again in a very soon upcoming Shrink Wrap Radio, and we're going to try to pitch it at a more layperson sort of level. Personally, I need that, and so I'm looking forward to it. If you've been listening to Shrink Wrap Radio for any length of time, you know that I'm a gadget guy. If you're a gadget person or have one in your life, Brookstone.com is one of the best places you can shop. Brookstone isn't just about gadgets, though. They're America's number one retailer of innovative gifts and products for your home office, bedroom, bathroom, kitchen, yard, and more. Brookstone is known for offering an assortment of consumer products that are functional in purpose, distinctive in quality and design, and not widely available from other retailers. We have a Brookstone affiliate link on our site at shrinkwrapradio.com, and clicking on that link will save you 10% off your order, plus helps to support this podcast. Or you can just go directly to brookstone.com and use the discount code SHOWRAP, that's SHOWRAP, at checkout. So I think that better wrap it up for today. Remember to send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com, and that you can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails for me on Skype, where my name is ShrinkPod, and you can leave voicemails using my Chingo. You can send MP3 files, or you can call and leave a message on our phone at 206-337-0622. Thanks to my guest, Daniel Everett, for sharing. Thanks to my guest, Daniel Everett, for sharing his exploits and discoveries working with the Pitahan of Brazil. Next week's show will feature an interview with Dr. Colleen Long about her adventures creating alternative careers with a background in psychology. That should be interesting. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.